The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 31st of July, 2020. On the podcast today, Warwick Brady, Chief Executive Officer, and Lewis Goodwood, Chief Financial Officer of Stobart Group, that STOB ticker there, and the guys discussed current trading and the strategy for the future. Also on the podcast, Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, gives his views on the markets, his strategy, his performance, and talks about ClearStar and Lloyds Banking Group. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a lot of other content. In fact, there's an article or blog there on Savannah Energy. There's also one on Pirra's Investments. There's also one basically on the Opening Market Report. Check that out. Advanced Energy as well as one there. There's a video on the right there of Expediator. Plus, don't forget, our COVID-19 index. These are a whole bunch of stocks who may benefit through this, you know, sort of semi-lockdown, but this COVID experience we're going through. Some of them are biotechs, some of them are just suited to this kind of economy. Biggest rise of the day is Tiziana Life Sciences, up 14% to 217. The biggest fall of the day is Omega Diagnostics, down 5% to 57.5. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Warwick Brady, Chief Executive Officer, and Lewis Goodwood, Chief Financial Officer of Stobart Group, STOB. Guys, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks. It's Warwick.
Now, it's a lot of people know the Stobart Group, I feel, but you have changed and you're evolving. So can you give us a brief summary, of an overview as to what the Stobart Group's all about, please, Warwick?
Absolutely. So Stobart has got two core businesses. We've got an aviation business, which is primarily focused on airports, specifically the London South End Airport, which is a very valuable asset for London, and a renewable energy business, which is a biomass business, high growth, high cash generation, high margin, turning recycled wood into energy. And we've got some non-strategic assets, which we are divesting of, and we've already divested of the rail and civils business since we announced it a few weeks ago.
Yes, I was just going to say, because a lot of people have heard of the Stobart Group, and you know, it's quite well known. And like you say, you just announced the divestment of the rail and civils, so that's very important. So I think we, first and foremost, let's touch on, it's affected all of us, you know, most meetings, in fact, your AGM was done virtually, largely because of COVID-19, so we've all been impacted by it. So specifically, how has the company been impacted by COVID-19?
Yeah, certainly, it's Lewis here. We've got two businesses that have been impacted in very different ways. Our energy business essentially relies on the availability of waste wood that it collects, processes into biomass fuel and supplies to plants. This supply of waste wood was constrained following the lockdown. However, Stobart Energy has since benefited from a restart in the construction work, leading to increased availability of waste wood. So that's been good to see. Mm-hmm. Because of this, Stobart Energy is now able to achieve the contracted volumes that are planned for this year into the plant. So that's a positive that we're seeing coming back through quite quickly, even with COVID carrying on. The impact of COVID on the aviation sector clearly is far more well documented. And we believe that the world will find ways to manage or cure the COVID virus, and that aviation will recover with people continuing to want to travel. And London South End Airport, as Warwick's already touched on, has an opportunity to create further value in the medium term due to three key factors as we see it. The ability to establish an enhanced passenger experience post-COVID, the opportunity to offer cost-effective base of operation for the low-cost carriers, and the airport's location serving London, which is the most populated city in Europe, as we all know, and one of the most visited places in the world. We anticipate that will allow us to see recovery as we move forwards.
Yeah. Well, you know, talking about recovery moving forward, you know, it's hard to give any sort of guidance. We don't know, you know, what the future holds. It's a moving line, isn't it, when we get a vaccine and all that stuff, so we don't really know. But what's your strategy for the business going forward, if you could?
Yeah, thanks, Justin. the strategy of the aviation group, sorry, the Stobart group is very clear. We're going to be an aviation business focused on airports, specifically London South End Airport and aviation services. Airports are very valuable long-term infrastructure assets. The world is going to keep moving. You know, COVID will eventually die down. People will still go on holiday. People will still travel. And I think so that's the key focus of the group. We also have a renewable energy business, which is the other core part of our business, which is highly cash generative. It's got high barriers to entry, got high margins, and we are seeing that business rebound as the construction sector rebounds back. And we want to be able to monetize that business in 18 to 24 months to further invest in our London airport. We then have obviously non-strategic assets. And as you mentioned, we've already divested of our rail and civils business, and we'll be divesting of all of our other non-strategic assets over the next 2 or 3 years. So clear strategy, aviation, specifically on airports, high value for shareholders, and also energy, and then divest of that in the 18 to 24 months.
Yeah, and you've recently raised some money. Take us through that, if you could.
Yes, certainly. So we announced a placing and firm offer in June the 4th, at the same time as we concluded our year-end results. We initially were looking to raise 80 million and ended up raising 100 million funding from our investors. That is a real positive for us. That was a very big message from our existing investors and some new investors, that they understand and believe in the strategy for the long term. We also arranged new banking facilities on the existing facilities, but we also put in a further 40 million RCF facility. The reason that we've done that is that clearly we want to make sure that we've got the right liquidity and the right headroom to manage our way through this as we still navigate through COVID. We've got two incredibly valuable assets in the energy business and the aviation business, and we wanted to make sure that we had the headroom and the liquidity to manage our way through those businesses.
Yeah. And so what would sort of at the moment be your sort of main message to current and potential shareholders?
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Really clear and simple messages. So in aviation, the world is going to keep moving. We've got a very valuable asset, London South End Airport. It is a very, very valuable airport and will be in the sort of medium to long term. We've got an energy business, which is high growth, high margin, high barriers to entry, and we're going to monetize that in 18 to 24 months, which will effectively make us debt free. We'll be able to invest in our aviation business. The sum of the parts business is significant and doesn't reflect our market cap, as you'd expect the chief executive to say. Pre-COVID, we issued an RNS about a potential partnership to buy a minority stake in the airport, valued at £700 to £800 million. We also did a valuation on our energy business of around £250 about 1 year ago. So as you can see, there's significant value there that needs unlocking. And then we've also got a significant amount of cash and liquidity over and above that to see us through this very challenging times of COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I do on the podcast every day, I tend to highlight the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets platform. Now, to get there, to get in that list, which is on the front page, people have to hit that follow button. So in summary, guys, if you could, three reasons why someone should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Really simple. We're undervalued. Enormous opportunity for realizing value through growing and managing our assets in aviation as well as energy. We have significant opportunity in the energy business to realize value for shareholders in the next 18 to 24 months. And you know, this is an opportunity to invest in really two areas of the business in industries that are going to be really they're at the bottom, and they're going to be highly valued in the next few years.
Excellent, guys. Warwick, Lewis, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Cheers. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hill, equity analyst, full-time investor. You all right, Paul?
Yeah, morning, Justin.
Now, last week, I covered, you know, I didn't know about Clearstar, and I covered them in a video, and, you know, you do a lot of search, and so I looked into them. I just thought, I like the thematics behind this. They're growing, they're taking on new customers. They were sold off, you know, quite big style during COVID-19, but It's often, do you know what? I just bought this book, Paul. You should get it. I know you find it funny, right? But it's they've studied 365 companies that were 100 baggers. They're real companies. They're not just made up how to find. And there's a lot in it about, you know, sometimes you should never sell a business. If the business is improving, don't worry about the share price. Don't worry about the share. And that's a lot of it in there, saying, you know, a lot of people have lost patience. They've sold out because the share price has gone down for like a couple of years. And they give an example, actually. One of them is like Warren Buffett company. It's like went down, this guy recommended it to somebody else, and then it went down like 53% in 1 or 2 years. And then it went down to like $38 in the 70s. And then, of course, it's now at like, what, $350,000 a share or something ridiculous. And so that's the kind of thing. So don't lose impatience. If the business is improving, the share price won't always reflect that. And so...
Oh, yeah, you're right. I mean, another example is... When I sort of started sort of professionally investing back in 2003, I really sort of like got my head around and ummed and ahed about investing in Amazon. And if you remember from the dot-com crash, it hit down to about sort of like, you know, $12, $13 per share, basically just because people thought the thing was going bust. And I think Barron's ran a headline which said Amazon.bomb rather than .com because it was all going to explode. Yeah. And if you think about it, you know, Amazon is an absolute classic case, what you've just described, because it's gone from $13 or $12 per share to now $3,000 in 17 years. And because of the, you know, basically the business has been improving. It is difficult. In fact,
it's worth saying that the results that come out today, record profit. They did $5.2 billion in the quarter. That's double last year's quarter. And so it's the most they've ever earned. So it's still improving. Yeah. So if people are still holding shares, why not still hold them? It's still improving. It's fine, you know?
Yeah, I think it's sort of like how your system works as much. And the only reason I would say if the shares do take a surge and go through what you believe is the fair value and has got a bit of momentum, then you might find, and this is what I do, you know, occasionally, you might find you actually want to sell the shares into strength, i.e. a valuation at higher than you think it's worth, and then redeploy the funds into other opportunities if you know which way, you know, which funds to go to. But I'm with you. If you've got momentum and you've got a direction of travel and there's a very long runway for a company, which that clearly is with Amazon, then you might as well hold it. And I mean, that's what's proved true, isn't it? I mean, hey, you couldn't complain really with 2,000 or 20,000% profit, you know, sort of over 17 years.
Yeah. Well, in the book, the writer is saying he bought something. What was it called? Potash of Saskatchewan, right?
And
it was like a play on the China growth story, and it made sense that it hit him. So he bought it at $2 a share. He held on for 3 years. He got 4 or 5 bagger out of it, which he thought he was quite impressed with. And then in 1996, he just got tired. He was treading water, and he just sold it. If he'd held on to 2007. He would have had 100 bagger, and if he'd bought even earlier, it was a 200 bagger. So, you know, 4 or 5 times to return is very good. But like I said, sometimes just get bored of something, get out. Even though the business is improving and the share price is going sideways, sometimes, you know, if the share price goes sideways but the business gets better, it's sometimes a lag, and all of a sudden it'll take off. But that sort of lack of patience, and there's a good phrase in there saying, "Don't make an investment decision based on a non-investment reason." And that means if you get bored, that's not a reason. Or the share price travels sideways, that's not a reason. You know, so look at the business. And yes, it's worth reading. I mean, I'm only at the sort of third chapter, but I really like it. I mean, there's a lot of common sense in there. You think, yeah, do you know, we're wired as humans to want to do something. You have quarterly reports, so you should feel you should be doing something at least once a quarter, and even, you know, once a month, or expecting what's coming up in the quarter. So we're almost wired, you know, Wall Street is wired to make you want to trade more often rather than just sitting there on an investment that could do well over the long term, you know?
Yeah, and I think you need to be disciplined, and that's the key. If you've got a system that actually works for you, i.e. whether it's sticking and focusing on certain set areas, whether it's momentum, whether it's value, whatever it is, if something works for you, don't throw it in the bin, you know, stay with it and stay disciplined. Don't go out into areas that really you haven't got any expertise and you're just rolling the dice, because you'll dilute your returns and dilute your hit rate. And I think that's a sort of classic, and it's easily done. I mean, you go through phases, particularly if you're in small caps. Sometimes you go through some good phases and you have 2 or 3 really good years. And then you sort of like, yeah, you go through your Joseph coloured dream coat, sort of like famine of 7 years, or not quite that. But, you know, you go through 2 or 3 years of really sort of like, you know, tough, tough conditions, even though the market might be going to. But if you stay disciplined and you have a system that you believe, it gives you confidence that actually going forward, you can do well. I mean, I'm a case in point. You know, when the market absolutely flew back in 2017, my portfolio went down because I had an idiosyncratic risk. I got hit by a couple of things, and it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't very nice. And then back then in 2018, 2019, particularly in 2018 when it sold off hard at the back end of the year, I mean, I had terrific years, 2018, 2000, again because of my stock specific strategy, the businesses that had, you know, I'd believed in and kept with, even though they'd gone down by 50-60%, because I still believe the fundamentals came back really strongly, and that was great, and it sort of helped it. And then, you know, this year, because I've had basically stocks that were doing brilliantly, well, the companies were doing brilliantly underlying it at the start of the year, got absolutely wellied by COVID-19. And, you know, I've basically, you know, taken a bit of a bath on overall portfolio. But because I'm sticking to a disciplined investment strategy, I have the confidence that, you know, things will come. No, those businesses are not gone forever. They're going to get through the COVID valley. There's going to be a lean period, which is what I've been through before, and it's painful. And you know, you haven't met your benchmark, but not that I have a benchmark. But you know, you other investors.
I was
going to
say, do you look at the? I mean, I literally looked upon Barclays last night with stockbrokers, and they got an analytics page, which is annoying because it only goes back as far as the furthest I can go back is 2017. They do the charts. They do a good breakdown of the figures from 2017. They started a new platform, which I started really, you know, seriously investing. I suppose just financial crisis before then, really, and so done very well because I come from a low base. But do you measure your performance regularly, or what? What do you do?
Oh yeah, no, I record it formally once a month, and I you know basically update it as we go through the month. So I can absolutely tell you, as per now, the 31st of July, how much I've done over the last 20 years already, particularly years, you know. So if I remember rightly, I think I've done it was a lot better, but over the sort of like the starting from March 2000, my stock portfolio has gone up by an average annualized of 13.8% per annum, which it was about 15, but hey, you know, 13.8%, I've got to be delighted, because I'd have never guessed it would have been that over the time. But it's taken a bit of a hit last, year to date. And not surprisingly, because it tends to be small cap stocks that have idiosyncratic risk. And some of them, I really doubted whether they'd get over the, basically the COVID valley. I mean, I'll just let you know, yeah, the last 12 months, my portfolio is down 6.5%, which actually is better than the FTSE All Share. FTSE All Share is down 15%. And then over 3 years, it's 5.8% gain. 10 years is, no, five, sorry, 3 years is 5.8, 5 years is 10.4, and then 20 years is 13.8, and it was higher. After I got 17% or just slightly more than 17% over the last decade, but it took a bit of a bath during the great financial crisis, which is not a surprise because everybody got a hit, but it was better. I did better than the overall stock market. So my alpha, if you look at it over the period, comparing against the FTSE All Share, the FTSE All Share over 20 years has done 0.6 and mine's done 13.8. So 20 annualized returns. So you look at the alpha, that's 13.2% over annualized alpha over that period. But I do take idiosyncratic risk. My portfolio has larger drawdowns even than the FTSE, and it's not in sync with the market. And so you've got to look like an idiot at times, and then you look like a star in others. And frankly, that's part and parcel of the game. You've got to have a thick skin, and you've got to be prepared for it. But if you have a disciplined strategy, and you have experience, and you're going to stick with what you know, then you're pretty confident that when, you know, your selections going forward, because you're learning all the time, will be better than the ones you've done in the past. Hey, I'm always learning, and I'm always knocking myself 10 bells out of my head, you know, in terms of, God, why did I do this? Why did I do that? And things haven't turned out. But frankly, you've got to look at the big picture, and it gives you confidence that going forward, you're going to do okay.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's got a good tool on Barclays there. You just scroll on a chart and see what area. And do you know what? Going into this year, I was very bearish anyway, so I was lotting cash, and the portfolio went down. But I started ignoring the noise and focusing on stocks again. And in fact, why I like this book is what it says that. One of the guys in the original writer of the 100 Baggers book, he was earlier on, he started looking at stocks from like the 40s onwards. He said he predicted so many bear markets, but they were a waste of time. He said he shouldn't have been looking at that on the macro bit. He should have been accumulating more of the stocks that it could have taken him from, you know, $10,000 to a million, rather than just focusing on macro events, all this stuff. And that's what I found. Now, this year now, I focused on stocks. I went big on a couple of stocks. And now from January, I'm up 38%. So
You're up 38% since January.
If I drag this along, you're not going to believe this. I've gone big on several multi-bagger stocks, right? And I'm going to tell you how much I've done, right? And you won't believe it. I'm looking at right here on the thing. I want on Barclays website from October 2017 right until today. I've done 576%.
Wow. Fantastic! Congratulations. I should be interviewing you.
It's obviously getting harder. The sort of bigger your portfolio gets, the returns. I can't get that kind of returns now in smaller cap stocks. In fact, you go very big in small caps. Like I say, you are like. I did sort of show your name on the video last week. I said, "Oh, there's a familiar name there on the shareholder register, Paul." And because you got over 5% of them, don't you, Clearstar? You've got to have the conviction, see, to go big that big and hold, because you can't. I've tried to buy stock in that company. It's hard to buy some. It's hard to sell in any sort of size. So you've got to be very confident for years of holding that. So what's your exit strategy? Because you can't just dump it in that company, because you won't get out, will you, really?
Well, I mean, I don't have an exit strategy at the moment, and you know, and the reason is because I believe it's fundamentally undervalued, and I think they're actually, you know, the shares are being sold off on a technical basis. I mean, you know, if you actually look at the activity and the volumes going through, I'm pretty sure there is a seller out there, and I'm pretty sure I know who it is. I mean, publicly disclosed, one of those shareholders on that list that you put in was Artemis Venture Capital Trust, which owns about 4.6%. Now, it's actually said publicly that it's closing its fund and it's having a voluntary liquidation of it. So it's actually selling it. Now, normally...
Yeah, that's annoying. I thought that, but I don't understand. Like you said, you said this, I asked you, I said, which one is it? Who is Artemis, is it? Because I said, I can't see, there's no notifications yet. TR1's coming out. So what's the score?
Well, that's quite interesting. It's because Clearstar, because it's an American company, is a non-UK incorporated issuer on AIM. And the rules associated with foreign companies do not mean that you have to declare above 3%. The actual threshold for the equivalent for an overseas company is 5%. Now, that's interesting, because if they're at 4.6% threshold for overseas is 5%, it hasn't got to declare if it goes between 4 to 3 and 3 below. So that, I'm pretty sure that's why they're not disclosing. Hey, I don't know whether they are. It is Artemis, because they haven't got to make a disclosure. They haven't made it. But publicly, through their RNSs, they have said they're liquidating their funds, and I would not be surprised if it's them. So,
there's a seller there, definitely, because like I said, it will rise. Then you get this, you know, ongoing, you know, this sell. You see us dripping in, because, like I said, after the video, it got a lot of interest. It was most followed on Vox for like 3 days, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people like it. I've had people contact me today, you know, on direct messages saying, you know, they like it and all that stuff. But they said, what's happening? Is there a seller there? And they said, it must be, because it's Italy. It just drags back down, doesn't it? There's no activity.
Yeah. They're just liquidating their position. There's no doubt about it. I mean, again, I come back to the fundamentals of the business. It had a good last year. It then got hit by COVID. Q2 was pretty awful, like everybody else. Had that huge drawdown in the number of, or increase in the number of unemployed, and nobody was hiring. You had then... you know, basically the January and May, they were even on the lower, you know, the increasing turnover in May and in June, sorry. And they were EBITDA positive as well. So the momentum is increasing. They're getting back. They're still not back to where they would be on a like-for-like basis, but they got back to where they were in from where they were in February. And I think the momentum and the direction of travel is going to continue. So I'm pretty confident that Q3 is going to be better than Q2. I believe Q4 will be better than Q3. And that's even if you overlay the US presidential elections, which are disrupted. And then I actually, you know, as I mentioned before, I'm quite positive that we're going to find a medical solution. And that's going to be an absolute game changer, because just think, if we get a headline saying we have an effective and safe vaccine for COVID-19, that is just going to make massive difference to consumer and business confidence around the world, which means that people and companies are going to start rehiring ahead of effectively a major reopening. And that will happen, in my view. I haven't got financial forecasts out there, because it's unfair for me to put that out for the company, for the rod for its own back. But the way I'm sort of like thinking about it is that we're getting increasing momentum. As I say, the low was Q2, Q3 will be better. Well, sorry, the low was April. May and June are better. Q3 is going to be better than Q2. Q4, I think, is going to be better than Q3. And then probably by the spring of 2021, you could see an absolute surge in hiring, rehiring spree across the states, particularly with the holiday season. I mean, just think how many people around the world have been cooped up, haven't been able to go abroad on holiday, and they're actually itching. I mean, I spoke to a finance director this week, and he says, I haven't been on holiday all this year, and I could spend a fortune. I could go anywhere I like. And I promised to my wife and my kids, and he's got three of them, we're all going to have a massive, massive splash out holiday in the States next year. And how many people are going to do that? Lots of people, because they're going for a double whammy of sort of like luxury. So I actually think next year you're going to get a double effect, a double sort of positive tsunami here. You got a huge rehiring spree, as you would when you reboot the economy on the back of an effective vaccine. Plus, you're going to get a whole bunch of holiday makers heading around the world wanting to actually splash the cash. So it's going to be, that kind of thing is really going to put a sort of like a rocket booster underneath, most economies, particularly the US. And that's going to, and ClearStar is going to be a major beneficiary. So as I say, the direction of travel, Q3 higher than Q2, Q4 better than Q3, even though you've got this overlay of the US election. They may not make any difference if we get a vaccine in Q4 or even at the end of September. We might get a very good Q4, who knows? But then we'll get a major step up in 2021, and you'll see H2 in 2021, in my view, much stronger than H1. And you'll see Q2 in 2021 really, really strong. So, yeah. And they've got enough money to get through. So, hey, whilst there's a center out there, I don't expect the shares to do that well, but you could certainly see the stock trading up ahead of that trajectory. I mean, just think, if you wanted to basically invest in a really, a good management team with excellent sort of best-in-class software, with, superb customers, and with large recurring revenue streams or repeat revenue streams, and, at a very, very good price, if you saw that trajectory for next year, why wouldn't you go at something like ClearStar? And so I believe once we get that news and the sellers out of the way, and I'm pretty sure it's not too far out, then you could see the stock move quite sharply ahead of perceptions that 2021 is going to be a lot, lot better.
I heard this said somewhere else as well, that founder owners companies tend to pull longer term better. And I know Bob owns over a quarter of the company, but I had someone say a comment, I think it was Mark from Twitter, said Bob was very almost pessimistic and honest. I said on an interview he saw on, and I said, yeah, and he owns a quarter of the company, so I said it's very refreshing to see that, isn't it? But this this update was very bullish. I thought the paragraph I liked It said, overall, during the period, ClearStar made significant progress onboarding previously won customers and continued to generate new business, and is greatly encouraged it's not lost a single customer through the pandemic, which is, I think that's amazing. So, and also just the growth in revenue in May, they've taken on what institutions, one, say, a sizable household name, investment bank, an HR business, outsourcing customer, the latter customer, which is a market cap of $2.6 billion, operates in 70 offices throughout the US, typically fills more than 4,000 recruitment positions a year. They appointed ClearStar in H2 of 2019. Also, during the first half, they said a NASDAQ-listed company, there's a win, and they said revenue from that is expected to generate, it's not generating at the end of this month, which we are now. So, again, and on top of that, they said, in addition to this, first half of 2020, ClearStar signed an agreement for an integration with a provider of end-to-end technology solutions for home healthcare agencies. So there's a lot going on there. You know, there's onboarding, there's new customers. I said, I think we've seen the worst is behind us, like you say. We have a kind of second wave thing now. It may dampen sentiment a little bit, but I think you know, economies are getting better than they were. They're not just shut down, at least, you know, even if they're at quarter capacity or half capacity, at least they're not shut down, you know.
Yeah, and the other thing, just to take reassurance from as a shareholder, when you look at the downside risk, is if we do go through a bigger spike than we expected, or for instance, there's a lot more uncertainty associated with the, you know, the presidential election in Q4. If that does happen, Bob and Barney, the chairman, are serious, in, you know, sort of like executive directors. These guys have been around, you know, the hoops many a time. They know what levers to pull to make sure the business does well in the long term. Fundamentally, there's no way they are going to let this one sort of like, you know, die by the vine at all. They are really good, solid, strong executive directors, strong management team. And that gives you reassurance that, yes, there's always going to be problems in any business, but these guys are going to get that business through it. And then once we get through to the other side and we get into the better times in 2021, then everybody can enjoy the upside. And I believe, and that's why you, when you come back to me, you must have confidence. I believe the downside risk from current levels is fairly small compared to the upside opportunity, which I can easily see this one. Even if I put sort of really quite, you know, modest expectations in, which is what, you know, which I've talked about, and we only get the benefits of a vaccine in Q2 of 2021 yet. Even if I do that, I'm still getting a value in three digits, okay, a fair, an intrinsic worth. And how much is that in compared to the existing shares? I mean, it's nearly three times, you know. It's, yeah. Well, so, hey, if I could generate that every single 12 months, I'd be delighted. So,
yeah, well, let's be honest. I mean, someone asked me, I said, listen, they're pretty much EBITDA positive now, monthly level. You know, their revenue is $23 million, £18 million, and their market cap is sub $13 million. So there are not many companies like that valued below their revenue, not even one times revenue, you know, which is nuts. So, yeah, you know, a fair value, let's say two or three times. Okay, cool. So that's clear. So I like them. I just think we've got to get a good... But the thing
it's
is with the seller...
It's a buy and hold.
What's nice for the seller, though, is all of a sudden, one day, there'll be no news, but the share price just rises. You think, what's happened there? And it'll just rise on a small buy, you know, because the seller's gone. And you think, oh, here we go, seller's gone.
And there's lots of catalysts. Let's say, for instance, because of the spike... Then the CDC, which is the Center of Disease Control out of the States, who are effectively the regulatory body for all COVID-related, you know, sort of testing, etc., they suddenly say, yes, we're going to clarify all of the guidelines for employers to be able to do employee testing without, you know, sort of like worries about getting litigated by the employees on data privacy and stuff like that. If they clarify those rules, then they've already got five customers. They've already got five orders who want to put business towards them. I mean, that's going to be the first catalyst for starters, you know. So if you get a vaccine, that's another catalyst. And if the presidential elections, you know, don't prove, you know, sort of like so onerous that, you know, then again, another catalyst. So, you know, there's lots and lots of potential share price boosters over the next sort of like, you know, 6 months.
Yeah. If we have the election in November, Trump is trying to postpone it until he's more popular. Until we get a vaccine or something.
Interesting on that one. I actually think he's just wanted to change the news flow, didn't he? He wanted to change the argument because of the spike in infection. So he wanted to move on to some of the different topic.
Yeah, exactly. He wants COVID to be behind him before he gets elected. Okay, listen, you bought a while back Lloyd's. Lloyd's had an announcement yesterday. They dropped a little bit. And what's your thoughts there on Lloyd's?
Well, I had a look at the results, and it was quite amusing because I went down to, it was surreal almost, because I went down to for breakfast with my wife, had a, well, a cup of tea and et cetera, and just said to her...
You both came from your separate wings and you met in the dining area. Yeah.
Well, I get up a bit earlier, you see, and then we were in the kitchen, and I said to her, you won't believe this, you know, I actually looked at the Lloyd's numbers, and I think their kitchen's sinking. I was quite positive about the outlook, and they saw, you know, the economy recovering, and I said, but I don't know what the shares are going to do because, hey, you know, they're basically like Billy No Mates, the whole banking sector. Everybody hates them. It's the most hated sector by a mile on the stock market, which is good set for sentiment-wise, you know, oversolds, etc.
Yeah.
So anyway, surprise, surprise. I thought the results were going to go, you know, I thought it was were reasonable with the outlook. And actually, because of the extra provisioning, the shares dropped by about 8%. Now, they're around 26p. I mean, the tangible net book value is almost double that. It's over 51p. So you've got potentially that gap of, you know, a gain of 100% on a large cap stock. And if you actually look into the detail, I mean, I've got to go through the presentation and all the, you know, detailed RNS, but sort of top level, the basis behind the increase in credit loss provisions is simply because they've changed the economic assumptions from March to June. It isn't specific against actual what they're seeing at the coal phase. It's just sort of hypothetical provisions that they've put in. And likewise, Barclays and Royal Bank of Scotland, or effectively NatWest now, they've had to do the same because it's just on the accounting treatment. You would put an overlay of how they think the economy is going to be modelled going forward, and then they just put broad brush assumptions about what that means for credit losses. Now, the important bit was that they might not get anywhere near that, and if they do, if that doesn't actually transpire, i.e. we get a vaccine, for instance, then a lot of that stuff is coming back. And then even if it is as bad as they said it is, most of it is actually going to be taken up, you know, on a capital basis, simply because they haven't, you know, had to pay a dividend out. I mean, if you actually look at their capital adequacy, it actually rose, you know, on a percentage basis because they hadn't paid the dividend out from last year, which saved them like 2.25 billion Lloyd's. And with a following wind and a better sort of economic outlook, I mean, I think, you know, these are, it's just so hated, the banking sector, as proved, you know, yesterday with the Lloyd's results, against numbers that, frankly, you could just stick your finger in the air and say, well, you know, do you believe these credit losses? And even if they are as bad as that, the balance sheet is still absolutely rock solid. It isn't a problem. It's only if it goes really nuclear and we don't get a vaccine, which I don't believe, or we go into a major, major economic sort of like depression next year rather than an upswing, which I just, again, I don't believe, then yes, the banks won't do well. But big picture-wise, you know, do the government want to throw the banks under the bus? And the answer to that is no, because they're a vital cog in the recovery of the UK. You know, they are effectively the transmission mechanism of all the money. So there's no way the government, and so they've been viewed in this light rather than the great financial crisis as one of the main helpers of getting the country back on its feet, whereas in the great financial crisis they were sort of like the epicenter, they were the sort of the culprit. So the sentiment has changed hugely, and I still think they can get masses of cost out of that business. And what's quite interesting is that Lloyd's have put on hold their redundancies that they announced at the start of the year, and that cost can come out at a later date. So All big picture, I came out of it thinking, actually, I might add to my position at these levels, not actually sort of like, you know, doing it just even hold. Because I think there's good value. And yes, the net interest margin dropped and expectations, but everybody knew that was going to drop. But if you assume that these guys on a return on capital employed can do high single digits, which is pretty modest assumption because they were doing double digits beforehand, but let's just say only that, you know, then what is your personal cost of capital? Yours and mine for small caps is about 12%, or maybe yours is probably even higher than that. I don't know, depending on the sort of how micro cap you go to, but it's that sort of level. Whereas most big institutional investors, their sort of like benchmark tends to be 6% or 8%. And so if they can get 9% or 8% out of Lloyds, they'll pay net book value for a stock. And what is the net book value? It's 51p. They told you yesterday. And it was strange that the shares are trading at 26. I mean, how many big cap companies, unless you take a really dark look at the economy and say, crikey, we're going to go into, you know, sort of like the 1930s style depression, which I just do not believe. But
no, that's not going to happen, because I mean, they know that what you know, they're going to learn from that lesson. They didn't actually stimulate enough during that time. The only thing that got them out of it was World War II. So they know that that's never going to happen. I mean, they know they need to get people back to work as fast as possible. I think what the problem is the unknown certainty of how many businesses will go through. And of course, as we know, they've been forced to loan money out and all that stuff to maybe these zombie companies. So it's the depth of the damage, I think, from these companies that may go through. And we don't know how deep that damage is, really, do we? And the stops with the bank. That's the thing.
Well, that's where you need to be specific in your stock selection. So if you actually look at the UK banks, who lends out most on the commercial, which is what you're talking about, yeah, for zombie companies? Yeah. And that falls squarely into RBS. It's still got a massive back book of that sort of stuff. It goes into Barclays, because Barcap has been doing shed loads of it, yeah, and on the investment banking side, and HSBC. HSBC has had a surplus in the UK of deposits, because it's had to ring fence. It's been forced by the government after the great financial crisis to ring fence. It's had a surplus of cash, and has been dumping it into corporates around if you actually look at most small caps, who are their bankers? It's HSBC, because they've basically had surplus cash. Now, the exception to the rule is two, but Lloyds is one, because most of its assets are, you know, basically straight mortgages. And if you actually, that's their bread and butter. So if you just look at what the key driver is of loan losses on their mortgages would be, it's house prices. And do you honestly think house prices are going down when Zoopla said only last 2 weeks ago the house prices had risen 3.5%? You had On the Market this week saying it's inundated, this pent up demand of people buying, etc. So I actually think this, if you strip out, if you look at individual banks, Lloyds is probably the safest and securest, because most of its assets, its loans are to mortgages, and they should be pretty much rock solid. You shouldn't get sort of like, you know, high loan losses. Yes, I could see it in the corporate environment, but they just haven't got big exposure to that, particularly to the really sort of challenged areas of energy, dining, leisure. So that's why I've gone for Lloyds, because I actually think it's a more sort of, but it's getting tarnished with the same brush, and you're not seeing that sort of like idiosyncratic sort of like loan book benefits coming out. The other one I would also say has got a similar sort of balance of loans of Lloyds is Virgin Money, because that's basically largely mortgages as well. So that's another one to look at. And they trade at ridiculous. I mean, Lloyds today trades, in my view, trades 50% discount to tangible net book.
Let me ask you a question here, though. We all get this, right? We all like a stock. We fall in love with a stock. We research it and buy it. Do you worry of confirmation bias in your things? Because can you, at the moment, like I said, what is the worst case scenario? Because obviously we are bullish on the stocks we buy. It's hard to be objective on a stock we hold, though, isn't it? Do you think that sometimes, can you be objective in Lloyds and say, what's the worst case scenario there? Well, I mean, let's be honest, it's not going to get that bad, is it? Because it's a bank that holds a lot of mortgages, so you know, they've got to support it. But what is your worst case scenario there? How low can this go before you think I've made a mistake here?
I have an expression that most small cap investors need. The sort of key sort of emotional characteristic they need is to be paranoid optimists, okay? I.e. they basically need to be always looking for the next sort of like, you know, asteroid coming over the horizon. So yes, you can fall into having that confirmation bias, but I equally, you can fall into the trap of getting too negative on stuff. Yeah. So you've got to reach the right compromise.
That happened with me. Yes. Looking at all the noise, I got too negative on looking at the noise. I thought, hang on a sec, this is not my game. Trying to predict. I know people on Twitter who've got hundreds of thousands of followers, and all they are is doom mongers, like Dr. Doom and all that stuff. And all they do is that, and they know it riles people up. That's why they get followers. But they predict, you know, the stock market crashing massively every year. Of course, one year they're going to be right, but they carry on doing it. And I thought, I got caught up into that. And I thought, do you know what? Stick to your knitting. your game is small cap stocks, you know, and stick to that. Look for decent companies. Look for making money, and that's it. And don't worry about macro, because I haven't got any sway over the macro. I don't trade the indices. I don't do any of that. It shouldn't bother me, you know. I just look at the stuff.
And
that's it.
And it comes back to your thesis. You go into a stock, you buy a company on the basis of a thesis about why you think it's good, why it's undervalued, what the management team's like, why is it, what the key drivers are behind the company and the industry that it's in. And usually best as a discipline wise to write it down. But so you have that sort of like why you've actually, the rationale for actually buying it. There is, in my view, there is no reason if the share price goes down to sell if that thesis is still in place. All it means is that it's better value. Now, whether you buy more, you know, and you want to sort of like, you know, put money in it on a gradual basis, then that's whatever strategy you decide to do in terms of investments. But if your thesis is whole, there's no reason to sell out.
That's right. It's true. A couple of people have said to me, I mean, and they often say this, you know, or friends on Twitter saying, the share price is dropping again, and there's sort of worry. And I just say, well, it's getting cheaper, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And sooner or later, bargain hunters will come in and start buying it up, and that's it. You know, and that's what happens.
But this come back to your original question, the confirmation bias. Mm. You've got to test, you've got to prod, you've got to kick your thesis all the time and question it, and to say, look, this is why I bought it. Does it still hold, or am I actually clutching at straws? And typically, I find, if my thesis has been blown out, then I'll sell and I'll take a bath on it. But most of the time, the actual thesis is fine. That's one of the reasons why. And how many times, you know, and I've said before, I carry a lot of idiosyncratic risk, but there's masses of times I've had quite big positions in stocks over the years, and they've gone down by 50 or 60%, and it's been really painful, and they've been at that position for sort of like, you know, 2-3 years. And then they come sort of like, the thesis really starts coming through and investors start realizing, actually, this is a really good business. And then the shares come back and the stock comes back. So it's a matter of keeping faith in small caps. They can be out of favor for a long time. And I mean, look at Bloy. You could look at the thesis and if you say, well, it's going to be really horrible in doomongers, then all the banking sector's going bust, which is what I came to the conclusion before they did all the central bank stimulus and the government support. And then you have to change your thesis and say, well, actually, when Rendemosphere came out, I remember having a chat to you and said, that's a game changer, because it means the direction of travel for a medical solution is that we're going to get one, and we could get one sooner rather than later. And importantly, we're going to get through the second spike without locking down the entire economy. Yes, we're going to have local whack-a-mole strategies, as Boris told, you know, with likes of Leicester and Blackburn and places like that. But overall, the economy is still going to be ticking over, and we're going to get through 2020. And 2021 is going to be a lot better, and particularly H2 is going to be a lot better than H1. And it depends on your time horizon. If you can see the light If you fundamentally believe there's not going to be a medical solution and we're going to have a massive second wave, as we did with the Chinese flu back in 1918, and it's going to kill three times more people than it did on the first wave, then yes, we've got a major problem on our hands here because we're going for a huge lockdown. But I just don't see it.
No. Let's be honest. As we know about it at the moment, the coronavirus, the more we know about it, we know it affects, in a rude way, it's affecting really fat people and really old people. And essentially, the rest of us can, you know, we of course try to shield those people or people with health conditions. And I've been talking to a guy who's involved in this area, a CEO this week, and he's saying what will happen is, generally, the vaccines will come out. The first generation probably won't be that effective. The percentage rate won't be spot on. It won't be in the 90s. But they'll be given to the people most vulnerable. And it'll take a while for them to, obviously, get the production up and the logistics and sort that out. But the vulnerable people will be given them first, because the rest of us don't really need it that much. But they'll try and do that with flu and all that stuff, because that's what we want to avoid. But essentially, and then it'll get better, and the vaccines will get better and improve. And then the companies, which are very clever, like the AstraZeneca, who said they won't charge to make profit, they're charging cost on this. Yeah, it's a good thing for humankind. What they'll do is start making money on the iterations, the second generation vaccines, and every year you'll have to have the coronavirus vaccine, and they'll make money on that. So, but that's the way forward.
Just think what that will mean to confidence, both on the stock market and on Main Street, because consumers, once they know there's a vaccine out there, however effective it is, and it's going to get better. You're going to get better reiterations. Consumers are going to have, it's going to be a huge relief on that, on those guys, and corporates are going, likewise are going to be huge. So when it comes to the real world, it's going to materially improve sentiment and confidence.
Yeah.
And how is that going to be reflected in the stock market? Well, it isn't going to be negative, that's for sure.
No, exactly. Because if you look at it, the vaccine, basically, the people at the moment who have, in fact, my son's on the list, but he won't be affected by coronavirus because he has a sort of lung condition. But he's one of these people that says you have to have a flu vaccine this year. You know, and that's what they say to him. You're on the recommended list. So you'll have that level of people where the levels of maybe obese, diabetes, elderly people will have that you have to have a coronavirus vaccine this year. That layer then will be protected, so you won't get mass hospitalizations, so that'll take the load off the NHS, so we can operate on a normal level pretty much then. We won't need to vaccinate everyone, you know?
And if you actually look at what's been happening in the Southern Hemisphere, i.e. their winter at the moment, a lot of countries who have mandated face masks, likes of Chile, Argentina, Australia, and even Brazil, where they've had a real spike and problem with COVID-19. If you look at those countries, what's happened this winter with their seasonal flu infections? That some of them are just like 80% down in Chile. Even in Brazil, it's 40% down, and Argentina's about 60%. So the flu season, seasonal flu season, if you just wear a face mask, is huge. Is not a major problem this year. So you'll find, hopefully, likewise will happen in the Northern Hemisphere, and therefore you won't get this effectively double virus out there of adding COVID onto seasonal flu, because the seasonal flu infection rate will decrease materially because of people wearing face masks.
Yeah, exactly. The precautions we're using for COVID they're effective against the flu as well. So, marvellous, Cole, and... anything else you're doing? Anything else? One more minute. What's are you buying anything else? Are you looking to buy anything else? No,
I'm still looking. There's lots of good companies out there. The price isn't quite where I'd like them to be. But
what percentage cash do you have? I mean, just not including your house and all this stuff. I don't understand that. But I sort of understand what you mean. But if you look at your portfolio there, what level of cash can you buy shares with now? Then what percentage wise?
50%.
Is it? Wow.
Yep.
You were quite well off, aren't you?
Hey?
You were quite well off.
I'm living on the bread line, mate.
Well, that's expensive bread. Right, marvellous stuff.
Take care. Have a good weekend.
Cheers, mate. Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Omega Diagnostics, like down 5%, 57.50. At four, Eurasian Mining, down 3.4%, 17 pence. At three, Evgen Pharma, up 3.24% to 12.75. At two, Synergen, down, well, 0.5% at £2.01. And at one, Tizian Life Sciences, up 14%, 2.17. Let me just check Synergen a sec, because it had that massive rise, didn't it, a while back. I just wonder how much it's come back by. It hasn't come back that much. So in that day, it went from 40 pence up to pretty much, 2.50, 2.40. And that's at £2. So it hasn't come back that much. Still sort of five bagged in a day. Wow. Okay, let's look at the top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Goldplat, signing of term sheet, sale of Kilimapesa gold. At four, Arix Biosigns, total voting rights. Someone read that and liked that. At three, Tizian Life Sciences, proposed admission to the official list. At two, Salt Lake Potash. June quarterly report. Basically, they're saying that debt funding is expected imminently. That's obviously the final sort of piece of the jigsaw before they go into construction and production in March 2021. And the most liked RNS came from Feedback Group. Bleeper appointed major NHS framework, or to that framework. It shot up to over 100% yesterday, and then came back down to finish about 40% up. And now today it's down 17%. I think people are missing the significance of that RNS, maybe, because there's still only, 14 million market cap? They raised 5 million recently. And I did buy some, actually. IP, proprietary IP, and it's MedTech. It's sub 30 million. It's got cash on the fundraise, several institutional investors took part. So there was something good on there. And I just liked the fact that Bleeper, of course, their sort of tech product, their image and messaging service, is the only CE marked product for digital patient imaging on the framework. And so it's got a, you know, a barrier to entry. It's a leader in the field there. Okay, that's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.